Sunday, June 25th, was one of the strangest days I have spent as First Lady. We began very early at the ranch, 6:30, coffee and juice, and getting ready for an arduous day that I faced with reluctance. It was to be Lyndon's second meeting with Premier Kosygin at Glassboro, New Jersey. And sometime the day before, he had asked me very casually, "Don't you think it would be a good idea if we asked Kosygin's daughter to come with him and you took her to lunch?" I drugged my feet as much as my sense of duty would permit. I simply did not want to be prized from my comfortable bed of calm and pleasant hours. It was actually only with a half acquiescence from me that I heard sometime close to dinner, we were at the Haywood, that yes, she had accepted. She would be there with her father. There followed that evening a period of complete misunderstanding, confusion, and disagreement between Lyndon and me over how it should be handled press-wise, broken by a restless night, the only nice part of which was a rub by Chief Baltimore, who told me an hilariously funny story about what the Chief of Police of Glassboro said when he was presented with the fact that the summit meeting was going to be held in his town, and he, with a force of 16 policemen, 4 of whom were on vacation. The Chief of Police is reported to have said, "Ain't this a bitch?" I made numerous calls during the evening until it got too late to Liz about how to handle the press and how not to. To Betty Hughes, who was to be our actual hostess, as wife of the governor of New Jersey, I was depending on her completely to arrange the lunch and 3 or 4 interesting hours. And to Mac George Bundy, and talking with him is always comforting to me. And my morning talk reported on the evening before dinner he had had with Mrs. Gavisciani. He pronounced her the easiest possible girl to get along with, intelligent, well-educated in political science and history, excellent English. You couldn't pick a better companion to spend 4 hours with when he's on deck in this job, as the expression is. He sheds an aura of comfort, to me at least. Betty Hughes, whose personality, lively intelligence, humor, and extraordinary articulateness far outweighs even her 250 pounds or so of solid flesh, had suggested a delightful day for us. Lunch at the governor's beach home, a New Jersey state park on the Atlantic seashore. It all hinged on whether Ludmilla Gavisciani would ride in a helicopter. Just before we were aboard ourselves, we got the word that she would. Among many other calls before leaving, I'd telephoned Bess 2 or 3 times about gifts, getting word to Mrs. Gavisciani that it would be a beach party, quite informal, rehearsing the scenario. I never felt so uncertain and ill at ease about a state visit before. I suppose because of all the confusion about how it should be handled press-wise. We had the stern admonition that the Russians, too, had to agree to and pass on everything that was said press-wise, and this was something I had never faced before. Mrs. Berg came at 8 and combed my hair, an absolute lifesaver after windblown days, and then we were in the Jetstar to San Antonio and Air Force One to Philadelphia, talking to Arthur about his trips to Russia, searching for topics of conversation with Ludmilla, reading the papers, and then changing into my brown suit. It's adaptable, it goes well. One cheery note was seeing Linda and Warren Lynn, who as always was all smiles and all happiness. We reached Philadelphia a little before 12:30, and then choppered to Glassboro. And here began an absolutely unique chapter in my experience. It was a little town, no more remarkable than San Marcos. The college campus was shaded by enormous oaks, had the aura of age, and Hollybush, the home of the president, Dr. and Miss Robinson, was Victorian red brick, turreted, old-fashioned, an almost prototype of the president's house of half a century ago. It was only later that I found out the things that had gone on in that house. In the hectic hours of Thursday night and Friday morning, something like 14 window air conditioners being put in, and telephones in every room, White House lines, and their very beds being moved out, the sofas and chairs, vintage about 1908, and the tables with curlicues, and the old family pictures, weddings, christenings, graduations, were still sitting around the rooms. It was absolutely delightful and could not have been faked. The real McCoy, a part of America. I thought it was an absolute stroke of genius to have the meeting in such a place as this, rather than in some elegant glass and aluminum UN conference room or Waldorf suite. But there were only a few minutes before we went out to meet Chairman Kosygin and his party. We emerged onto the steps of the old Victorian house, and up they drove, the hammer and sickle flag flying from the front of the black limousine. Across the drive, lined up under the oak trees behind a rope, more cameras and newspaper people than I think I've ever seen for any meeting. Most on the ground, some on platforms in the air. And there they were, Chairman Kosygin, a very solid, strong-featured man, 60s I should think, unbending and tough-looking, but pleasant enough, and his daughter, Mrs. Ludmilla Gavishiani, a very young-looking 38, slim, almost no makeup, casual hairdo, completely at ease, in an undistinguished navy blue white trim dress. She could have been a professor's wife on any campus in thousands of American towns. Linda Bird was with us every second. She stays as close to her father as she can. And it was apparent from the very first moment that she was soaking it in like a sponge. And I relaxed and withdrew a little, wanting her to take the lead. We stood for pictures quite a while, and there was a great roar of cheers from the crowd. And then at some moment, I cannot for the life of me remember whether it was after the Kosygins joined us or whether it had been earlier, we walked out to the roped-off edge of the hill. Down below us, over the drop, were massed the students of this college. There were only some 2,800 of them, and it was summertime. And there must have been great numbers of Glassboro citizens and others with them, because it looked like thousands of people, many with homemade signs, a large one in Russian, one that just said simply peace. All of them, in friendly, holiday, eager, hopeful mood, a tone of real friendship. It was a moving moment. We went back in the house, and I took Mrs. Gavishiani upstairs to give her an opportunity to powder her nose, laughing to myself at any legend she may have heard about the luxury of American bathrooms, because this one wasn't, although it was quite adequate. And then the Robinsons offered us a drink, iced tea, I believe. And then Lyndon asked us if we'd like to come in and see the room where they would meet. It was a long, simple table. There, beside Chairman Kosygin and the always glowering Gromyko, like an evil spirit hovering over the meeting, was the Russian interpreter, whom I think was very capable, and ours, Secretary Rusk and Walt Rostow, and the very affable Dobrynin, and patient philosophical Llewellyn Thompson, our ambassador to Russia, the very few others whom I didn't know, would all sit down to lunch together, I was told, about 16 of them. That would crowd the room. And then Lennon took us into the next room, where he and Chairman Kosygin had met on Friday, alone, just the two of them, with their two interpreters, and where they would meet again in about an hour. I had that chilly, spine-tingling feeling that I was face-to-face with something important. And then I looked at the chair Lennon would sit in, and it was the very twin of the one that sits in his boyhood home in the pink parlor, the one that Mrs. Johnson's mother had given her to start housekeeping with, Victorian, already well-aged in 1907. This one upholstered in green velvet, and behind it a sofa to match, also nearly identical with Mrs. Johnson's. What a day, this possibly very momentous, certainly dramatic confrontation, in a setting so quaint and homey, an authentic Americana. We said goodbye to the men, and to someone I said, God bless, and then had a quick thought, that's a strange thing to say to a Russian. Mrs. Hughes and Mrs. Gavishiani and Linda and I and Liz departed Hollybush, got into the chopper, and set out over the New Jersey countryside. It was a 45-minute ride, and Betty Hughes was the tour guide. No better one in all the land could have been found.
She pointed out
the acres of vegetables below. Her state is called the Garden State. That many truck farmers, and there were hills of low, thick scrub pine, the cranberry bogs, and once we went over a racetrack. Always throughout the trip, there was a long double line of the great highway that brings the thousands of tourists from the big metropolitan centers to Atlantic City. I pointed this out to Mrs. Cavicciani and told how American highways were such a great part of our economic life and how recently we had begun to try to add to them aesthetic values as well as their great functional ones. I want to send her home, too, with a sense of the rising desire of American people for beauty in their lives. We went over a drive-in movie. We flew over Atlantic City itself, and I pointed out the big convention hall where Lennon was nominated in 64. Then, as we flew along the Atlantic coast, Betty showed her a public beach where anybody could come in for 25 cents, and there were places to change into your suit. The great, long, endless stretch of the Atlantic and the endless sandy beach. There were thousands of people sunning and swimming. It was a great sight. I saw the boardwalk and the big hotels, and I was every bit as interested as Mrs. Cavicciani. It was apparent from the beginning that Linda Bird took to her, and she, I believe, to Linda. They talked most to each other, and Betty Hughes, our official hostess, was an endless, excellent, highly amusing talker. And I was quite quiet, and so was Liz. There was never any need for an interpreter. And as Mac George Bundy had said, she was really unpretentious and very easy to be with. Then the weathered gray clapboard house right on the shores of the Atlantic came into view. It had been the governor's summer residence for some 10 or so years now, and at present housed Governor and Mrs. Hughes and about 7 of their 10 children, not to mention the numerous visitors that are always in tow with children. With weeks of planning, we could not have provided a better presentation of the American home than this. 7 children, from Tommy, age 6, who was wearing a shirt with peanuts on it. This was one of the few things that stumped Mrs. Cavicciani. To the 18-year-old son, who had his surfboard handy and was ready to give a demonstration with his friends. To Betty's mother, who was spending the summer with them. And 3 neighbors who had dropped in for cocktails last night and who had been roped into cooking lunch since the cook had left the day before. I was more and more aghast at what we had presented Betty Hughes with. Well, the neighbors were all smiles, and the lunch was delicious. Chicken cooked with wild rice and wine sauce, and tossed salad and fresh New Jersey strawberries. Served with powdered sugar and whipped cream, they were delicious. Talk ranged from an American supermarket, which Betty thought she really ought to see. Mrs. Cavicciani said she was afraid she couldn't get in one and really enjoy it without being swamped by a crowd. She had tried to go to Macy's because she had heard it was the biggest department store. She really wanted to see it, but the press and the crowd had become so overwhelming that she had bought the first pair of black shoes she could get and fled, she said. To education in Russia. He told us everyone started to school at age 7 and went for 10 years. And that, I gathered, was similar to our elementary and high school put together. After that, they were at college level. And the competition was very keen, she said, to go on into what would be considered our university education. I spoke of this being a state park we were in and described some of our national parks to her, and found her quite conversant with the names, at least, such as Yellowstone, which she said she'd so much love to see. Asked her about parks in her country, she said they had no system of national parks as such. But as industry grows, and as the great industrial cities grow and expand, they are feeling the need to maintain some green wilderness, as she put it. And I believe, she said, that it is in the planning for the future. I asked her if a stranger went to Russia and had only a few days, such a person as me, what should I try to see? And there was the usual nebulous answer to that very nebulous question, so varied, so diverse her country, just as ours was, so much to see. But of course a stranger would want to see Moscow. One can always learn from the capital of a country. And then she thought perhaps Leningrad would be the most interesting. It was like Venice, built on the water. It had been built by Peter the Great. He spoke of them with great ease, although I've sort of assimilated the legend that Russians don't look back to their past on the other side of the revolution. Anyhow, she said, it was built 200 years ago, and the rich men around Peter the Great brought in architects from Italy and France and Germany and built great homes and palaces, and it still bears a stamp of a European city. It was easy, talkative, and at times quite animated, and I couldn't help but salute her for being willing to come here all alone. She was so far outnumbered with Americans, no counterpart from her country, although we had asked her if she would like to bring a friend. She and Linda chatted quite merrily. Actually, she's midway between my years and Linda's years. She seemed quite impressed with the kitchen when we took her through, and Betty gave her the full treatment about the washer and dryer and disposal and all the electric gadgets and the relative ease of keeping house. And what a household, with 7 children, mother-in-law, and innumerable guests. With 1 servant, it appears. Meanwhile, Liz was taking in the small but interesting and innocuous bits of conversation and color, and relaying them to the very large-sized contingent of press who had been stopped down at the highway, a city block or two from the gray shingled house, right on the seashore. Its most delightful feature was a big picture window that looked right on to the Atlantic, and up the coast and down the coast as far as you could see, soft sand of the beach, and then sand dunes. And these, oh marvelous to behold, had been meticulously planted with little tufts of grass about 6 inches apart. Betty explained to me this was a conservation project to hold them there against wind and erosion. After lunch, I presented Mrs. Cavicciani with several books, The Living White House, and a book on the art treasures of the National Gallery, telling her I hoped she could come again to see some of our treasures. She and Linda had been excitedly discussing the Hermitage. And an antique mirror, a modest antique, circa 1780, framed in a sort of Chippendale mahogany, the sort of thing that a young bridal couple would have received as a gift about the time of our Revolutionary War. She had been discussing our history at lunch and was quite well versed in it, the dates of the war and the peace, and names of founding fathers. We also gave her a wristwatch. She graciously removed her own and put it on. Liz and Betty are both good managers, 2 of a kind, and this had truly been Betty's day, not mine. And presently, Liz said, in her eagerly polite way that almost always gets results, wouldn't you like to walk out on the beach so they can get a picture of you looking at the sea? So there we went, Betty and Mrs. Cavicciani and Linda and I, and faced the Atlantic with the wind whipping our hair, the sand up to our ankles, and the dozens and dozens of photographers jockeying for positions almost into the waves, and the pencils flying over the pads, how we turned to each other in whatever innocuous conversation one can conjure up at a moment like this. We had the governor's house and the sand dunes in the back, and then, of course, we reversed it. The press scrambled around in front of us, and we turned around with our backs to the Atlantic. Throughout it, Mrs. Cavicciani was good-humored and at ease. They asked her if this reminded her of anything in her country. She said yes, of 2 parts of it. The sand was like the Baltic, and the hot weather was like the Black Sea area in Georgia. Her manner throughout was very friendly, and all of us were at ease, but I did notice each time that it always was she who said, "We can go now, don't you think?" or "That's enough, yes." And when I try to think back about anything she said, there was absolutely nothing that couldn't have been repeated anywhere. Interested, friendly, animated, but it could have been from a guidebook. Back in the house, we sat down in the family room and shook the sand out of our shoes, about a half a teacup each. How I would have liked to have been on that beach barefooted. And then she had her eye very carefully on her watch several times and reminded us that her father said she should be back by 5 o'clock. We reassured her each time, and Jim Jones ushered us into the car and then into the helicopter, and this time we flew straight back with much less conversation, mostly between Linda and Ludmilla. We were back at Hollybush a few minutes before 5. appointed hour. The rows and rows of newspaper people had apparently not budged an inch. They were still under the oak trees in the wilting heat. It was a humid, sweating day, and the storm clouds were piling up above us. And down below, we could hear the murmur of the crowd, the students, the citizens of Glassboro. They, too, apparently had not budged. I heard later that people had gone through the crowd selling hot dogs and cold drinks, just like they were at a county fair, sort of making an all-day outing of it. Betty and Mrs. Cavicciani and Linda and I went back into the room that had been set aside for us. It was actually the Robinsons' bedroom, bed removed. And the doctor and his wife came in and joined us, and we talked of their school, and I told them about Lyndon's days at a very similar place in San Marcos, Texas, nearly 40 years ago. Dr. Robinson smiled and says, yes, that was well known to everybody that the president had attended a teacher's college. And still the men talked. Minutes and an hour and more passed. Reaching for good fortune, we all took this as a hopeful sign. I do not know just when they emerged. It was well after 6. They called us out, and Governor and Mrs. Hughes and the Robinsons and Linda and I and Mrs. Cavicciani went out on the front steps to join Lyndon and Mr. Kosygin, and the great battery of cameramen went wild. Pictures of the whole group, pictures of the two principals, pictures of the 4 or 5 of us, and then a very brief address by Lyndon, which said very little, and a somewhat longer one by Premier Kosygin, largely a repetition of thanks to the city of Glassboro, to the college, to the Robinsons, to the president. I cannot remember their words, but there was implicit in what they both said, the statement that they had made no great progress, but that they felt better for knowing who would pick up that telephone when they got on the hot line. And then, in response to the roars, we went over to the embankment once more, more carefully roped off now, it seemed to me, the Premier and his daughter, Lyndon and I, and Linda Bird, and he always reaches out an arm, Lyndon does, and brings in other principals, this time Betty and Governor Hughes. And we all leaned over and shouted down greetings and waves to the students and town people below. Kosygin seemed firm, tough, pleasant, courteous, all at the same time. I could not possibly take the temperature of what had gone on in those hours in there, except to know that it was no great victory, or else I could have read it on my husband's face. Gromyko glowered throughout, and Dobrynin beamed throughout, and then we were all saying farewells at the car. Special words have come again to Mrs. Cavicciani, and then they were on their way down to the open field and into their helicopter. We were right behind them in a following car. There we said goodbye to the Hughes and mounted into our helicopter, though we sat on the ground until our guests were aloft and gone. And then we waved goodbye to Hollybush and Glassboro, and a little before 7 were chopper bound to Philadelphia to change into Air Force One for Washington. It was a short ride home. The first word I remember Lyndon saying was, well, I'd say we didn't budge an inch today. Most of the ride was consumed with when and where should he make his brief televised report to the American people. It was decided immediately when he hit the White House lawn. There were TV crews there ready, with the microphone poised just a few feet from where he would emerge from the helicopter. He worked on getting his statement ready, and a little past 7:30, we were on the ground. It was a quiet speech. He conceded they were a long way from agreement, but there was a hopeful air. He said he thought their 10 hours of talks had made the world a smaller and a little less dangerous place. It had improved their understanding of each other's views, and that out of their discussions might come the beginnings for some future agreements. And then, by 8 o'clock, we were upstairs, almost the end of what must have been one of the most tiring days in my husband's life. I had thought that I would go bowling. I always welcome exercise at the end of such a day. But Lyndon got immediately into his pajamas, a highly sensible thing to do, turned on the TV, and I decided I couldn't miss a word of the remaining chapters. So we had dinner on a tray in the bedroom with George Christian joining us, and the evening consisted of innumerable telephone calls on Lyndon's part. Notably, I remember, to Senators Mansfield and Dirksen and Fulbright to report to them his feelings about the day's talks. And then, almost immediately after he'd gotten in bed, the chairman, Mr. Kosygin, went on a press conference at the United Nations. It lasted nearly an hour and a half. What an endurance contest. Because he, too, had shared this grueling day. I thought he acquitted himself quite well. Though gone, alas, was all the cordiality that had marked the outward manifestations of our meeting at Glassboro. He was very tough in reaffirming the hard-line positions on both the Middle East and Vietnam. He did give a ray of light and hope on one issue. He and the President had made some headway on a treaty to ban the spread of nuclear weapons. Not headway, but hope, a glimmer of light. They both had the same philosophy, aim, and they would work for something to come out of it. What a forum it was to have a press conference in, face to face with all the representatives of the countries of 120 or so nations, in particular the Arab nations, hanging on every word. Made more interesting because many of the questioners, naturally, journalists and TV people, were Jews, and the questions were tough. In the telephone calls that went on later, I gathered something of the feeling of those 4 hours of talks, that Kosygin unrelentingly thought of Israel as a perpetrator of aggression and drunk with power and intoxicated with success. In Lyndon's opinion, that he had come here for one purpose, to talk about withdrawal of troops. That was what he hammered over and over and over. Like George Bundy said, do you think he got notice that the first reports were too soft? That is, I presume, if you've been touched up between Friday night and Sunday morning by the Chinese and the Arabs. Kosygin had said something like this, I am charged by the Arab countries with selling them out. I am charged by China with selling them out. I ask you, have I sold anybody out? In answer to his repeated insistence that Israel had started the war, Lyndon answered in what I expect was considerable forcefulness clothed in mild words, that maybe perhaps the closing of the Gulf of Aqaba and the massing of Egyptian troops with statements that they were going to run Israel into the sea could possibly have been considered an act of aggression. Well, as we look back on the day, it was one great try. And even if no headway was made, the thirst of the country was somehow assuaged for a meeting, a face-to-face confrontation, a willingness to work at it. And I'm so glad Lyndon came and met him twice. And I'm very proud of him, and somehow relieved. And he is very tired. George did not leave until after 11, and it was 11:30 when Lyndon turned out the light and went to bed. One ray of light and humor and gaiety in the day is Warry Lynn's presence. For a brief while, I went in Lucy's room, and we had the happiest little talk. She says she and Linda have more fun than they ever have before, more to talk about, more devoted to each other.